Hi everyone, welcome to the Confident Hypnotherapist podcast. This week is the first time ever I've got a guest coming back. So, Mr. Paul Michel, thank you so much for joining me again on this podcast.
Pleasure, lovely to be back.
Now, there is a reason why I've asked Paul to be back, and one of the key reasons is I recently went through Paul's training here in Melbourne, and I was describing it at the time as being like the Matrix of hypnosis trainings, because there was very much the feeling that there was a red pill and a blue pill, and we went down a few rabbit holes, and everything that I thought that I knew about hypnosis kind of was debunked in some way, or challenged or tested, and put into a new context. And so I felt that while this podcast often goes into different directions, it is a good topic to talk about exploding some of those hypnosis myths that are commonly taught or that people seem to believe. And you know, I couldn't think of anyone better to do that with than with Paul. So
we'll see what comes out.
I know. This is the interesting thing with our conversations, Paul, is that no matter where it goes, it always kind of goes in very different directions anyway. Mm-hmm. But I know for me, and this is something, you know, I guess part of creating this podcast is that I allow myself to be vulnerable in these and to talk about some of those things where I question myself. I know that's not very common out there. I know a lot of hypnotherapists would probably prefer to just blow their own trumpet and talk about how fantastic they are, and they're more than welcome to do that. But I also believe a lot of people out there go through some of the similar concerns that I do, and that, you know, this podcast is really created in an attempt for me to get a better understanding of myself, but also for other people to piggyback off that and get a better understanding of them too. Mm. One of the questions I had to you, I think on the second or third day or even the second week, I can't remember, was that I said something like, I still get concerned. I can't remember the exact wording. You probably know which comment I'm referring to. I said something online that I still get concerned about if they don't go into hypnosis, or it was along those lines, and you very quickly turned around and pulled me up on it. Mm. I guess, you know, kind of an interesting starting point would be a lot of people assume hypnosis is a state that people go into, and that's very much not what the paradigm you work from. Can you perhaps expand a little bit more for people listening as to what you understand hypnosis to be?
All right. Well,
it's a big first question, isn't it?
You know, some people have been banned from forums on Facebook for that very question.
I did post in our Facebook group that question, and it got some really interesting responses from those who were very experienced saying, why are we still talking about this?
Yeah.
To a varying responses of people talking about you know, focus and relaxation in some cases and all sorts of things. But, you know, what definition do you tend to find works best for you?
Yeah, I really align with James Tripp's thinking around this. I can't remember it off the top of my head. It's James's words, but along the lines of the use of suggestion and direction and communication in order to alter a person's perception of reality. Or along those lines, or to lead cognition. So I definitely align with that. So, look, I've been down the path of thinking about it from a state-based model. So that's where I started, and that's the way I was taught. And I think, dare I say, that a lot of people are taught that way. Mm. And yet there are people who don't believe that, who get outstanding results. And you have to look at the fact that people are getting great results if they don't believe in that, which sort of, in my mind, busts the idea that perhaps we have to focus on a state-based model. I think we need to be mindful about what we reify and then deify. So what we then make it as sort of like the canon of hypnosis lore, so to speak. And when I mean lore, I don't mean L-A-W, I mean L-O-R-E.
L-O-R-E, yeah.
And then it gets to the point where people go, this is the way it is, and then we don't question it. And I really love the fact that there are plenty of people who are questioning that approach. And that was, for me, a very useful process to question the approach and look at people who didn't believe what I believed and yet still got great results. And we're going, take a look at this. There doesn't need to be a trance. And I went, all right, well, let's go take a look at that. And I did train with James Tripp when he came out to Australia in the early stages of his approach to hypnosis without trance. And dare I say, it was, you know, a really interesting experience, which then prompted me to ask more questions of myself and to be willing to be vulnerable, you know, to go through that whole process. And I just think that it's made me a better hypnotist as a result. I don't get caught up in, are they deep enough? Are they in or are they out? I remember reading a book by Cal Banyan and Jerry Kine on hypnotherapy, and they presented this idea that be as if they're already in hypnosis, which I'd already taken on board. But if we do take a look at hypnotic phenomena, then that's really what we're paying attention to and calibrating to determine whether they're in or out.
Yeah.
So if we just remove this idea of them being in or out and look at it through the lens of, well, what am I actually seeing and what's the hypnotic phenomena that they're demonstrating already, then perhaps there's already some stuff that's happening and I don't need to work too hard to elicit it or evoke it or amplify it. Perhaps it's already there and they've already got a skill set that I just need to leverage. And so this idea of using an induction to induce a state, I think that just confuses people. I think that just creates a bit of a rod for their back. And I also think it creates confusion for the client. So today I had a client that I was seeing and they were listening to a hypnotic audio that I'd created. And the concern that they had was they didn't know whether they were doing it right.
Right.
And whether they were in hypnosis. And so I have to go back and highlight for them that my perspective is, and this is the way I describe it to them. I say that what we're talking about when people think about hypnotic states is a type of hypnotic relaxation where there's this inward focus. It's deeply internalized. Their chunks of attention are very much focused on the inner experience that they're having, and their body is demonstrating a parasympathetic response, a relaxation response for all intents and purposes. So what we're seeing is a shift in the way their autonomic nervous system is working, and we're seeing a shift in the behaviors that they're demonstrating. We're noticing change in respiration and, you know, blood pressure and muscle tonicity and vasodilation or constriction, depending on what we're seeing. You know, it could be that they flush, it could be that they go pale. We're seeing changes in the way that they swallow, changes in rapid eye movement. But these are all physiological changes that we can notice. We can't determine the state. So when I highlight for them that in actual fact, the way I like to think of hypnosis is it's them following my suggestions and directions. That's the hypnotic process. And if they comply with that and do that really well, then they will experience phenomena. Now, those suggestions could just as easily be given for them to be more alert and awakened, you know, driving a car and be externally focused and be really, really present, you know, at the time. It could be that those suggestions could be geared towards relaxation, internally focused, engaging in their own inner experience and the internal representations that they're creating, their pictures, their sounds, their sense of smell, their you know, whatever's going on for them. The thing is that that's as a result of them following the suggestions and the directions that have been given. Now, the degree to which we are authoritarian or directive or invitational, permissive, there's still suggestion and direction. And so to me, that's the hypnotic process. So when I see them demonstrating relaxation, I call that hypnotic relaxation, not hypnosis. But that just clears it up straight away. It puts them at ease and they don't worry about whether they're deep, whether they hear everything or don't hear anything. I'm interested in the phenomena that they're demonstrating. And that's a relief for them as well, because then they can just trust the process and go with it. So the first thing is I get compliance from them that they're willing that they're willing to do what I ask or suggest of them without thinking, provided that it's safe and ethical for them, so that we can get that hypnotic process and that compliance frame and that cooperation principle going. And where it ends up that they're already demonstrating phenomena before we've even started, which I think that's what you saw. I'm just leveraging the stuff that I was seeing in real time.
Absolutely. I think I used the word because I've got my notes here and you know, my note was hypnosis being a phenomenon that we naturally create each day. A hypnotist observes the hypnotic phenomena and is able to hijack, amplify, and suggest with the notes that I did. I don't know if hijack is necessary.
I use the word hijack. I think there are times when if we're doing a certain inductive ritual, like a handshake, we might hijack the response hijack and leverage it.
The word there that probably could be questioned, but in my sense, the way I was using that was more that, you know, if I'm noticing that there is perhaps an arm levitation going on or the arm catalepsy there, that you would observe that and utilize. So utilize is possibly the kind of word. Hijack probably has more of an aggressive overtone to it.
It can't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Utilize, leverage.
It sounds like we're going to need negotiators just to get out of the situation. So.
Hypnoterrorist.
Yeah, hypnoterrorist. That's great. I like the, that could be a good yet.
Another podcast. I've got a feeling it's going to have a very different outcome for the people listening.
Exactly.
Jump on board the ride. We'll see where we take you.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's I think Jonathan Altfeld, one of the NLP trainers that I highly value and is over in the United States when he came out and trained in Australia quite a number of times. I've trained with him. He said something that really resonated with me, and he said, calibration is the mother of all skill. Mm. And so when I'm working with people, I'm calibrating and getting baselines and then noticing differences, because that is the mother of all skills. I mean, you can have a wonderful script, you can have your own patter, but if you're just busy flicking it out and not watching for timing and responsiveness, then it's just crossing your fingers, hoping stuff sticks.
Yeah.
And so therefore calibration is the mother of all skills when it comes to this, in my opinion, if you want to be good at impromptu and if you want to be good at just being able to just pick stuff up on the fly, you have to be able to pay attention to the other person.
I think one of the insights that I had after my training with you was also about whether or not I had been hypnotized myself by what I thought hypnosis was.
Mm.
And in the process of that, missing some of the vital things that others had said. So, you know that I've spoken quite frequently about Rob McNeely and his work.
Mm.
And, you know, I was going back over some of Rob's notes recently and recognized that a lot of what he said was actually very much aligned with what you had said. In fact, one of the quotes I got here was that he would say, Erickson would say the three most important things to do is observe, observe, and observe. And Rob would use ratification as part of that process as well. So, you know, as you were having that person talk about whatever it was that they were creating within their mind, that you would go up noticing that, you know, softening of the skin, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
But I also added words in because I always thought that Rob had said that hypnosis was an inward focus. And I know that was a thing that we had discussed and you had gone, no, it's not an inward focus. It doesn't have to be. It was a disservice to Rob. He actually said, and you see, hypnosis is an experience that involves focus and absorption that we can agree mutually is hypnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to highlight that addiction, for instance, is the same, the focus and absorption that creates the experience of addiction. And I kind of was reading that and going, maybe some of this stuff was right in front of me the whole time, but I had been hypnotized by my own thoughts of what hypnosis was, much like many people that come to see us. And in that process was kind of blind to some of the things that you were talking about in your training.
Was there a question in there?
Silence. No, it's an observation. I tend to wonder if that's what other people experience as well. whether or not that's what causes people to, you know, is it that they're believing before they go in to training that hypnosis is all about trance, because that's a word that's been used so frequently in the past, or if it's if the training is actually that bad, to be honest.
Yeah, I'd be reluctant to say bad or good or right or wrong, because who's to say that I'm right? I'm just...
It's a model.
Constantly working on a working theory and seeking to still find my way. I mean, it's been over 20-odd years and we still don't know what a mind is, and we're still trying to work out how the brain works. You know, even neuroscience can give us a bit of an insight, but it's like, I think the way it was described was, imagine you've got a stadium of 100,000 people and you're focusing in on this one section in the stadium. We still don't know how it sort of really functions. It's a great mystery. So look, it's hard to say. All I look at is, and I guess I've got a very pragmatic view, is, take that which is useful, test everything you get up front, and then determine whether it's not useful. So I've adapted Bruce Lee saying there, take that which is useful, discard that which isn't. The only way you'll know that it's not is if you go out there and you test it, and then if you've played with it for a little bit, adapted it a little bit, and it still doesn't quite work, then perhaps it's not useful for you. Yeah. And I think that coming into a training with the beginner's mind, and this is one thing I really valued about your approach when you came into my training, is that you were willing to be vulnerable and you were willing to put things aside and you were willing to just give it a go and see how it worked for you in that moment, and also then to take it into the clinical environment or to put it into practice straight away. And that takes a lot of guts, because when we're peeling the layers off what we think we know and what we're comfortable with, we're going to go through that clunkiness again. Mm. And for some people, that's quite a concerning experience, because
I had a horrible following week.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a great thing.
It was one of the worst weeks I'd had. And I think it was a combination of, I was exhausted, not from necessarily from your training. It's just mm-hmm. been such a busy, busy period for me personally. So it's a combination of exhausted, and I just felt like the most awkward hypnotist on the planet. It really was about, I felt like I was back at square one. And then the following week, it kind of shifted the other way. It was like, oh, suddenly everything was like, I felt like one of the best hypnotists on the planet. And to be honest, I still feel that pendulum, the pendulum kind of swaying a little bit, even still the ripple effect afterwards.
Mm.
It's quite interesting that the mind seems to be readjusting on everything I've known for the past 6 years as it absorbs in and begins to adapt.
Yeah.
Other stuff that I've learned.
Well, we move through unconscious incompetence. In other words, we don't know what we don't know. Then to conscious incompetence, we now know that we don't know.
Mm.
For some people, that can be quite a reality slap,
mm.
especially if they thought they knew what they thought they knew. And then once you discover that there's something you don't know how to do, then going out there and playing with it, that's where the clunkiness comes in. That's where we move into conscious competence, and we're paying a lot of attention and effort to what we're doing. And that, if you've already been playing in the unconscious competence space for a while, to come back into conscious competence can be quite confronting and can feel very jarring. Mm. But my job as a facilitator when you come on a training is to create perturbation. And that's really about, you know, like I said to you at the time, imagine you got a jar of juice that's been sitting on the shelf for a while. It's settled, and you got that layer of sediment that's sitting there. It's to shake it up and to have it move around a little bit, so you can sort of have that experience of re-examining some of the things that were sort of sitting there that you probably didn't know were there because they'd just been habituated and outside of conscious awareness, and then determine utility again, because you're at a different place to where you were 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And you're training with a lot of people. But once that perturbation is happening, that's where we move back into conscious competence again. And for some people, there's no comfort in that.
Mm.
And so when we move out of our comfort zone and we lean into our learning zone. Well, there's no comfort in the learning zone and there's no learning in the comfort zone. So my role as a facilitator is to create perturbation. But then again, when it settles, it doesn't settle in the same way.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that happens inside the training that is also about reframing your perceptions of yourself as you're facilitating the process and what your involvement is inside of that. Because I think a lot of people come to hypnosis and hypnotic work with this, I'm going to do stuff to people. And in actual fact, when you actually unpack some of these processes, and that's what we do quite thoroughly, is you realize that the hypnotist or the hypnotherapist is leading them and modeling the phenomena. Now, is the hypnotist in a trance? Are they in this inwardly focused, deep, as we would call an NLP, downtime state? No, they're in this uptime, externally focused approach where they're modeling hypnotic phenomena to lead the person into another experience. And so dare I say that it's important that we have that facility and that capability as well. So if we believe that being in this internally focused downtime trance state is hypnosis, then what's going on when the hypnotist is externally focused, uptime, moving around, making conscious decisions, trusting their unconscious mind, facilitating processes, watching the feedback that's coming back? Like, where is this special state? That's what I keep coming back to. And is this state also so pervasive that people can experience joy or happiness or, you know, past drug experiences all inside this special state? Like, this is where I question the status quo around that.
Yeah.
Because we don't say you're permanently happy all the time, even though you're sad now. We go, you're either happy or sad. So why is it that with all the stuff that we see inside of a hypnotic interaction, we say that they have to be in this trance state and all these other things happen inside of that? Mm. To me, that doesn't gel well with all the other stuff that's going on. So yes, I'm not surprised that you were challenged on lots of levels by me sort of going, take a look at some of the contradictions that I myself are still working through.
Yeah.
And I'm open to being proven wrong.
I think the interesting was the redefinition internally of what hypnosis is, and therefore, how do I describe it? How do I offer it? And, you know, that was both an incredible experience and sometimes a confronting one as well. But it's also fascinating because it shifted how I view things in many ways. So, for instance, you were talking before about just observing, and, you know, I'm even thinking, because, you know, really when I'm talking to you, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, what kind of insight is going to be really valuable to people listening to this? And I know that for many people, their definition of hypnosis is someone sitting in a chair, eyes closed, you know, draw at the side of the mouth, seemingly in this altered state. But we also have clients at times that sometimes don't do that, that sometimes seem quite alert. And the immediate thing that we might say from that is, oh, they are not in hypnosis.
Mm.
And yet, is that because we're not observing what phenomena we're getting properly? Or what is it that if you were in that situation where you had a client who seemingly was still very much alert, what kind of troubleshooting would you do in that moment that would get you back onto what you felt was that right track? Is it about bringing it back to that observation?
First of all, don't worry about whether they're in or out. Be as if they're always in.
I can't change. Well, I can't. No, there you go. There's a belief that was coming up there. I can change 6 years of saying in and out. It's just more that at an unconscious level, it's still happening.
So. But you can see how that preoccupation continues to then drive some of these questions.
Absolutely.
It's like troubleshooting. I'm going, be as if they're in and notice what they do well. Come from a strength basis with it rather than a deficit, rather than focusing on what's missing. Pay attention to what's there. And so if we take a look at it, everyone's capable of demonstrating hypnotic phenomena. It's a natural part of our experience. Emotional state changes are intensely hypnotic when you take a look at all the stuff that's happening under the hood. And people just call it an emotional state change. But when you take a look at someone going from, you know, being happy to sad to mad, for instance, if they're the only three emotions they experience, then they've got a short fuse. But if you take a look at the dramatic changes, it's quite phenomenal. Now, how much of that is consciously mediated?
Mm.
Very little. And so there's a lot that's already naturally happening. So from that perspective, I think that's the reason why I moved away from the state-based model, is because I don't get caught up in the preoccupation of, are they in or out? Are they deep or are they shallow? Is it at the working state of hypnosis? Mm. And because I don't have the preoccupation, I'm interested in, what am I seeing? What can I facilitate? What can I make observations about? Now, you know, the observation piece is really useful, because when you make observations of stuff that's happening in real time and you're using behaviorally based terms, then you're using pacing statements, you're using truisms.
Mm.
And that creates a really nice feedback loop for the person who's on the receiving end of that. So, I'm not too fussed about the troubleshooting. I think I'm going to address some of the root cause of the preoccupation. Is, if you're busy worrying about whether they're in or out, be as if they're in and behave as if they're already hypnotized and notice the phenomena that's there. So I think that just, it reorientates your reticular activating system to focus on stuff that's present rather than things that aren't there. It's much easier to notice what's there than to try and notice things that aren't there, because you're always going to be looking at a gap.
Yeah.
And there's an absence of something. What is that something? What do I need to see instead? So you got a tote that doesn't quite end.
No, I get that. And, I think the more you can bring yourself to being aware of what you're observing, the more you have the ability to be able to just bring yourself back to what is in front of you right away.
Yes.
And then I think you can utilize that.
I think this comes back to, I don't know how familiar you are with the TOTE model, test, operate, test, test, operate, exit.
Test, exit, yeah.
So the test or the trigger feeds forward the criteria for the second test.
Mm.
And when that is triggered or fired, then people can exit the strategy that they're using. Up until then, they do a whole bunch of stuff. That's the operate phase. So what happens when we're looking for stuff that doesn't exist, either we have to create it and then it triggers the test that allows us to then exit with some sense of positive kinesthetic element, usually, not always. But the thing here is, if I'm constantly noticing what's there, then my totes are constantly being triggered that I can exit and move to the next thing. If I'm looking for something that isn't there, then I have to keep working hard. That's the operate phase, until I can finally see evidence of it. So when people are looking for this imaginary state
that doesn't exist
yet, that's hard to define, of which the criteria perhaps is quite limited, how do you exit your tote? And that's the reason why I keep highlighting that that's when they move into a type of troubleshooting. But my perspective is, if I'm constantly looking for what is there that I know is hypnotic phenomena, then I can easily move from one strategy to the next strategy and be quite adaptive and leverage what's there. But also, coming from a strength-based perspective, to me resonates well with what we're seeking to do as a facilitator of people's experience who are perhaps coming to us with issues in their life. How do we build them up and use the platform of success to get them to where they want to go through an iterative process, through incremental changes that we build on? Why not do that inside of the hypnotic process as well? And so we often talk about a no-fail protocol, setting your client up in such a way that they can't fail. Then look for what they do well, reinforce it, build their confidence, build their competence, build their congruence, and keep building on what they do rather than trying to create stuff and do stuff to people that they're not demonstrating right now. You'll be able to leverage into that stuff once you build up enough of those competencies. But some hypnotic phenomena for some people is so far away from their average everyday experience that it's too big a leap. And so we want to make sure that we're building platforms that they can leverage into it. And that's, I think, what we saw in the training, is you saw people over a period of time go from perhaps being a bit wary of hypnotic work, who had never experienced hypnosis never before, experienced to all of a sudden demonstrating some profound hypnotic phenomena.
Mm.
Yeah,
absolutely. We did have someone in the group who had not experienced hypnosis before, and by the end of it was just remarkable in terms of what she was able to create herself. It was quite an experience to see that happen.
There was an important moment, though, which was the difference that made the difference.
Mm.
Because the turning point was getting her to agree and to make that agreement within herself to have an experience.
Is this, and I guess, you know, one of the things that you said, and one of the things that I think, you know, almost every hypnotherapist that I know that trains well says is about the importance of the pre-talk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you yourself, I know, said that it's probably the most important part of it as well. Do you feel that are we linking back to that in this instance?
Absolutely. And one of the most important things that I think that's often overlooked is that a lot of people come in and they think the hypnotist is going to do something to them.
Yeah.
Because that's what they've seen. They don't know any different. And you can tell them they've got all of the, you know, like they've got the capacity or the choice to either accept or reject suggestions. I don't want to set that up as you've got the choice to reject or accept suggestions. But I do want to make sure that they have committed with themselves to have an experience and to welcome everything, which is a very different way of thinking about it. Because to a degree, sometimes they've been very good at saying no to stuff and they're wary. So the biggest thing that we need to overcome is fear and uncertainty and this perceived loss of control. So I often highlight that one of the things that we need to, you know, to be clear about is that they need to a degree, give up conscious control, to give up control, to get more control. And then I very quickly link that to, they do that every night when they choose to go to sleep, because when they try to go to sleep, they often have their worst night. But when they set the intention, create the conditions, and then let themselves go, they end up having a wonderful night's sleep, because it's not a consciously mediated process. They set the intention and then they give themselves permission. And so from this perspective, I think important elements inside of the pre-talk are having the client make an agreement with themselves, not just with the hypnotist, but with themselves. Now, when I say themselves, notice plural, not with themselves, but with themselves. In other words, all the parts of them, to have an experience, to give themselves full permission to have an experience. And when they do that, now they're committing. Now, what I usually do is I get them to close their eyes when they do it, because I want to get them used to having their eyes closed. Right? But, you know, close your eyes and give yourself or give yourselves full permission to have an experience. And when you're ready, open your eyes. It sounds almost like a hypnotic evocation already, doesn't it?
Very much so.
So when they're ready, they'll open their eyes. And so I want to make sure that first and foremost, there's an agreement with themselves, and then there's an agreement with me. Are they willing to do everything I suggest or request of them without thinking? And so those are really, in my opinion, the things that I wish I'd known way back when, that I've absolutely laid into my pre-talk, because suggestion, direction, compliance. And the interesting thing is, and I think one of the things that I think surprised people by the time we got to the sort of final stages of the training was how permissive and invitational I actually am. So it's that mix of direction and suggestion, invitation and permission, being authoritarian when necessary, and then being very, very permissive and hands off and very much the facilitator. You know, it's good to be able to do it all.
Because, yeah, I found that hard because we all know how directive I am.
Yes, of course. In my approach.
I think I'm probably king of permissive, aren't I?
Are you asking me permission?
I thought the other part that was interesting about your training was that it really did focus back in on the hypnotic phenomena that we experience. And I found that that was something that other trainings I've experienced may look at. But for me, it felt like there were additional levels going on with the way that you talked about it and observed it and noticed it and how we could work with that as well. And, you know, that's, again, not a question. It's an observation and a comment. But I'm hoping that anyone watching this is thinking, wow, what the hell does Paul do in his training? That is so different. I must go and check that out. But it was interesting because now I look at, you know, some inductions that have been scripted and go, oh, what are they doing here? Oh, they're doing this here. They're doing this here. They're wanting to bring in hallucinogens, all that sort of thing as well. So I think that that's another area in hypnosis that if people haven't really explored, they absolutely should, because I don't come across it much in trainings that are out there, to be honest.
And that's partly because, look, I really value my NLP training, because that's helped me to think that way, you know, more process than content. It was really interesting to watch, really interesting to see that that Michael Yapko has really emphasized that, you know, process orientation.
In his new book, yeah, it's fantastic.
I think it's great to see that material come out, because definitely from an NLP standpoint, we're interested in process, not necessarily content, and how things are playing out rather than the content that people obviously put into the process. So, you know, I remember when we started talking about me running a training and so forth, I think one of the things that you asked me, I think, was, you know, would I run it online? And I said, no. And for me, the magic of being in a room with people moves beyond the mechanics of the inductive rituals. And I think that's the reason why it's not the formal demonstrations that, in my opinion, are the magical experiences that people have in the training. It's the stuff that we catch on the fly, that when I notice something, I go, hey, take a look at that. I think at one point in time, one of the participants, who will remain unnamed, was about to volunteer for a demo and came to the chair. Try to get out of the chair. And I went, what's more stuck, your bum or your legs? And in the moment, in that moment, they went, my bum. And then next thing into sticking phenomena. And that stuff, you don't quite get it online, right? You can sort of facilitate that sort of stuff. But when people are seeing it in a real time environment and it's happening in three dimensions and you can see all the different elements of the quality of the experience, then that enriches their calibration skills. Because in that moment, what did I notice about that person's response that led me to offer that suggestion and then just test it out and see whether I got the feedback? So the phenomena is happening all the time. And that's where I think those informal demonstrations of what's happening when people don't think that they're in a hypnotic experience, all of a sudden it's there. And that's why I think it's quite a challenge to this paradigm that people have to be in this inwardly focused downtime state. Because when stuff is happening in real time in the room and it's phenomena we see usually with people who are in supposedly the deep working states of trance, and yet it's facilitated spontaneously in the moment impromptu, then that poses some interesting questions for those people who are watching it and going, where was the inductive ritual? Where was the deepener? Like, it just was there. What the hell?
Suddenly kind of emerged, yeah.
Because it's there all the time. We just have to have the eyes and ears to see and hear, and the, you know, the sensory acuity to calibrate to changes in responses through arms, and, you know, especially if you're touching people, if you're in that environment. I think part of the reason why a lot of trainings, and this isn't to be disparaging, because I've been on a lot of those trainings and valued them tremendously, is that there's a tendency to focus on the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
And then it's the mechanical elements and the rituals. And so it's, for what purpose are we doing that? And what is it that we're really trying to evoke and elicit? And how are we working with other people's, you know, nervous system and endocrine system and this really vague and artfully vague term, their mind?
I will say endocrine system sounds like something out of Star Wars. I'm going to have to go and look that up.
Yeah. It's a type of cruiser, you know, that's
what it is. Right.
Yeah, it's a Battlestar it's cruiser. The endocrine system actually a whole galaxy. So just letting you know.
Is it? Are you being serious?
I'm just messing with you.
I was saying to someone recently that there is almost this catch-22 about creating a podcast like this where it really is about talking about our vulnerabilities. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think many professionals would necessarily want to do that because they don't want to be seen as being anything less than the best. But I also don't think that's human. You know, the more we can kind of embrace it and go with that, the better. So, yes. And with that, I hope anyone listening to this, like, I mean, there's so many things that I took away from out in the training, which I know we've kind of re-explored here. But the biggest shift, I think, is when you recognize that you don't have to do anything to someone else, that they're already doing it. You just simply need to be present in the moment, observe, and work with that. So,
yeah, it does take a lot of pressure off you, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me back.
Everyone, I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast. I look forward to seeing you in the near future. In the meantime, stay safe and well. Take care. Thank you for watching the Confident Hypnotherapist podcast. I'd like to invite you, if you're on Facebook, to come and find us on the Hypnotherapist Networking Group, particularly if you're a student or even if you're a seasoned hypnotherapist. You'll find a whole lot of information there regarding continued professional development that will help to build your confidence and effectiveness as a hypnotist. Come and join us. I look forward to seeing you there.